hello and welcome to Monocle 24's The Urbanist, the show all about the cities we live in. I'm Andrew Tuck. Coming up on today's programme.
I wonder now, though, since we're seeing, I think, the limits of vaccination campaigns, if we can't be more proactive in thinking about codes and strategies that would make our buildings and cities more pandemic resilient.
To bring in the new year, we're suggesting a few recent titles to add to your urbanist reading list for 2022. Today, we flick through the pages of two books that explore both our past and our future cities. From a release discussing how urban planners have shaped the built environment in response to previous epidemics, to a look forward at how designers envision our future cities will address issues such as climate change, infrastructure, and digital culture in the years ahead. That's all coming up over the next 30 minutes right here on The Urbanist with me, Andrew Tuck. We start this episode and this year with a timely look back. The most recent health emergency facing the world, the COVID-19 pandemic, has reignited debate about how our cities, through the help of architects, landscape designers, and urban planners, are shaped by their responses to disease. Urban designers throughout history have had to react to crises, and the ways in which diseases spread and epidemics interact with urban populations have shaped the very fabric of our built environment. Historic outbreaks of infectious diseases such as tuberculosis or cholera have also left their mark, and not always in a good way. While these changes were always intended to eliminate disease and improve our way of life, sweeping changes can often have inadvertent social consequences and even lend a helping hand towards future epidemics. Well, I'm joined now by Sarah Jensen Carr, Assistant Professor of Architecture, Urbanism and Landscape at Northeastern University and author of The Topography of Wellness, How Health and Disease Shaped the American Landscape. Sarah, thank you for joining me. Now, this book looks back at a variety of past epidemics, but it comes at a very appropriate time in our modern history too. Can you tell us a little bit more about what you explore in this book?
Ironically enough, this is actually a topic I've been looking at for maybe the past 6 or 7 years. And I actually turned in the first manuscript of this book in February 2020. Just before the pandemic hit the US. So I would say, even as somebody that's been looking at this topic for some time, even I thought maybe we were past the point of sort of infectious diseases changing the city. But what was interesting is even when I got the manuscript back after some time, I did see a lot of recurring patterns between the illnesses that I wrote about in the book and COVID. But to give an overview of the topics in the book, it really starts with cities in the Industrial Revolution. And actually, you know, London and coastal cities in the United States, such as New York and Boston, where I live, you know, much like COVID, sort of London was the bellwether for how cities in the United States would change in the wake of the cholera and yellow fever epidemics. So what's interesting about those epidemics is, much like COVID, they were very virulent. They were quite violent, of course, much more violent than we've seen with COVID, where people would perhaps die within a few days of contracting it. But what it spurred on was this massive infrastructural movement in Western cities to, you know, mostly move sewage underground and to think about the presence of miasma in the cities. And that is, you know, dangerous gases that people thought were making them ill. Although, as John Snow found out, of course, it was really through polluted water. That said, because the origins were somewhat unclear at the time, it really spurred on this partnership between engineers, between architects, public health officials, and doctors to overhaul the built environment, from paving streets so they could be washed down at the end of the day, of course, putting sewage under the ground, coordinated waste removal in cities, but also a large part of the effects of that were overhauling worker tenements and making sure that that housing had fresh air and sunlight. Then what's interesting, again, I think where the United States and the UK parallel is in the period after cholera and yellow fever, where there was still, you know, quite a few respiratory diseases in the cities. And what came from that is a massive park building movement in both cities, where a lot of landscape architects were employed at this time to sort of breathe fresh air into the city through urban parks to provide a place for urban dwellers to escape from the urban confines and to experience nature.
And again, can I just dive in there? Those respiratory illnesses. I guess when we look back at the city, many things were happening in the hearts of the cities that don't happen now. So, manufacturing, industry, slaughterhouses, all sorts of trades were cheek by jowl in the city at that time. Was that one of the things almost that came about through this attempt to control those respiratory illnesses as well? A little bit more zoning and understanding that it could be dangerous to mix these things too tightly.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, zoning sort of, predated maybe the urban parks movement, and that was also one step of, thinking about how proximity spurred on disease. But, another reason for this movement around urban parks is, I think, much like, we saw in the early days of COVID, the elite class, right, had the opportunity to escape the city and maybe go to country homes or elsewhere. And a lot of this movement to build urban parks was about equity as well, and to make sure that the working class had access to nature as well, that it would be close to where they worked, so they would have the time to go there in the day. And there was a bit of a paternalistic, I would say, drive to build them as well, in that people thought if the working class could mix with the elite in these grand parks, that they would be more civilized. But I mean, luckily, our lasting legacy with that, and again, many cities in the United States and in Europe as well, are these wonderful urban parks that we still enjoy and have proved to be timeless and even useful again with the rise of COVID.
And tell me a slightly more recent thing, something like tuberculosis and how that chimed in with modernism. Could you explain a little bit about how those two things went almost hand in hand, as it were?
What's interesting about the modernism movement and the rise of tuberculosis, and I should also say, just predating tuberculosis, the Spanish flu pandemic instead, which I think many people are referring to as a precedent for COVID, is the need for, again, fresh air, ventilation, this idea of sunlight being able to kill bacteria. Specifically, though, the link between tuberculosis and modernism, which Beatrice Colomina has written about really excellently in her book, X-ray Architecture, which I also, reference for this book, is this shift from thinking about disease being spread through miasma or through airs and waters. It also signals this growing acceptance of germ theory instead, this idea that we have to sanitize, and also this idea of sort of exposure to kill the germs that cause tuberculosis. And so we can see that in modernist architecture at the time, that was, of course, employed in many sanitaria, first in Europe, and then again, the United States always lags behind Europe a little bit, but in the buildings there, where you would have, sleeping porches that were built in tuberculosis sanitaria, where they were wide enough to actually bring beds out there. And in this case, sunlight and fresh air actually did prove very curative pre the tuberculosis vaccine. But what I find interesting about these buildings, which you can also see in Le Corbusier's concepts for housing at the time too, is this idea that sunlight and fresh air could be delivered in very sort of vaccination-like doses, right? That it was very exacting. So what we see in the relationship between tuberculosis and modernism, and also other aspects of the built environment in this time, is a sort of shifting of thinking of how disease spread.
Now, not all the changes tend to be successful or even good when you come to deal with other pandemics or other outbreaks of disease that come along subsequently. Could you explain to us where they made mistakes as well as successes?
Well, this book is sort of specifically about the movements that happened in the United States. And I would say one quite disastrous movement that also involves health and disease is this conceiving of urban blight in the 60s and 70s in the United States. What's interesting about this intersection is, although, medicine and architecture and urbanism had sort of split apart at this time, they were not united in the same way that you had seen in the late 19th and early 20th century, where they're actually working to sort of combat disease in the public realm. But, at this time of urban blight and people were trying to deal with this urban crisis, was at the same time where cancer became the primary cause of mortality in the United States. And in trying to conceive of how cancer spread, many were applying it to this problem of what they called urban blight, which is really massive urban disinvestment and racist policies. But you see a lot of writing from this time, from Sarnen, you know, from the US Department of Housing and Urban Development, talking about urban blight as a cancer and referring to cancer treatments at this time, which was complete eradication. And so using the metaphor of cancer to really justify, you know, this widespread clearing out of neighborhoods by telling people that it would spread, you know, most likely to the suburbs, which was how they got support for this, by comparing it to disease instead of actually sort of tackling the systemic forces that were causing real harm in the city.
Now, at the moment, when we look at how our cities are responding to COVID, for example, the built environment can change only at a certain pace. So you see lots of things which are happening, which are temporary, pop-up, a bit plastic, a bit perspex screen worldy. You're talking about quite concrete, in every sense, changes to the cities, you know, putting in new sanitation, rethinking the proximity to which people lived amongst each other. How quickly did the cities in the past manage to change to adapt to these outbreaks of disease?
Oh, I think that's incredibly important to remember. Although it feels like we've been slogging through the COVID pandemic for some time, and, you know, hopefully at some point we'll see an endpoint to all of this. Epidemics like cholera and yellow fever went on for decades. In fact, you know, multiple outbreaks over decades. Same with the respiratory diseases that followed it. And then, of course, tuberculosis as well. And so there was that time lag. And it was also obviously sort of pre-vaccine development. So there was really no choice but to alter the built environment in order to combat these diseases. Of course, we're still in the middle of it. You know, the pandemic has been going on for close to 2 years now, which seems like a long time to all of us, but is a short time in comparison to these other epidemics that I wrote about. And so I'm not sure what the result of all of this is. You're right. A lot of these changes have been very ad hoc, and they haven't come from architects and planners or designers, which is, you know, a bit of a shame. I wish we would be more proactive in rethinking, say, ventilation standards for schools to ensure fresh air, to rethink, you know, how can we distribute green space more evenly towards the city so people that live in crowded housing can have a place to escape to breathe fresh air. I wonder now, though, since we're seeing, I think, the limits of vaccination campaigns, if we can't be more proactive in thinking about codes and strategies that would make our buildings and cities more pandemic resilient.
Now, do you feel that, you know, it's a strange thing, but while these deadly outbreaks of disease are obviously terrible, that on the whole, they change cities for the better in a way?
I mean, a little bit of both. I try and show the range of interventions. I mean, obviously the sanitation movement, the urban parks movement, I think on the balance were quite successful in a lot of cities. Of course, we have to take into account sort of their legacy of displacement as well, and thinking about how these large scale projects also served as justification to remove populations that were viewed as maybe sort of, you know, incubators of disease. A movement like urban renewal in the United States, which again was not really connected to a specific epidemic, but really used a metaphor of disease to justify it, was quite ruinous. And it, in fact, has left this legacy of environmental injustice in the United States for communities of color who often still live in, say, redline neighborhoods that they were confined to because suburban housing covenants were locking them out of buying houses in certain neighborhoods for health reasons. But we're still seeing that effect today. And then there's movements that we can look at, I think, with a more nuanced view. The last chapters that I wrote before the pandemic were about the walkability movement in the United States and, you know, how we built so much infrastructure that's very auto-centered and very dispersed across the landscape and is almost impossible to traverse if you don't have a car. And I talk about how there are architects and planners and designers that have been trying to put walkability back into the neighborhoods, but it's often so rare that it actually can also be a catalyst for gentrification to include these sort of walkable amenities. And so how do we think of, you know, transportation access and walkable access as, again, a measure of environmental justice rather than just sort of a health amenity that you can purchase? So I think it's important to take all of these movements into account and understand, you know, what the benefits and fallout was from each one and think about how we can apply that to future epidemics.
Sarah Jensen-Carr there, author of The Topography of Wellness, How Health and Disease Shaped the American Landscape. And it's available now via University of Virginia Press. Next, we look to the future to hypothesise how our cities might tackle the challenges they're set to face in the years to come. Through speculative architecture and visionary design, planners can offer us their view of how our urban environment might address issues such as climate change, population density, infrastructure, and digital culture. While sometimes fanciful and potentially amusing decades down the line, imagining how our futures might look helps us to plan an environment that better utilises and protects resources as global urbanisation only accelerates. Well, I'm pleased to say that I'm now joined by Alan Griffiths, author of The Future City, Visionary Architecture and Design. The book looks at over 40 future-forward projects across themes including master planning and megacities, transportation and infrastructure, and smart cities too. Alan, let's start with your ambitions with this release. What did you set out to achieve with this collection of projects?
The Future City is about the future of urban architecture and design and planning. It's a coffee table book. At the end of the day, it's got about 40-odd case studies, heavily illustrated, and it's there to give a visual interpretation through the eyes of some of the leading architects working today on urban issues. I set out to explore this topic because, to me, cities have a vital role to play in helping us, particularly to live more sustainably in the future, but also just to live better lives. You know, more and more people are living in cities than ever before. That trend is set to continue. So I just felt it was an important time to look at what architects and designers are doing in this sphere and in terms of interesting work, ambitious work, looking forward towards how we can help to plan more sustainable, healthy and equitable cities for the future. I was fortunate to be able to get Ben van Berkel, the principal of UN Studio, to provide a foreword to the book. They're obviously one of the largest, most progressive architecture studios working today, and they have many projects in the urban realm, so he seemed like a perfect fit to provide the foreword.
Now tell me, you've grouped these projects in different ways, and as you said, these are all nascent projects in the way. These are things that people would like to build or putting out there as examples of what could be possible in the future. Could you give us a couple of examples of the categories that you decided to group things around where you saw the most radical thought happening?
Yeah, that's right. So I wanted to look at work that's being completed at the moment, but particularly work that's progressive or speculative and examining what the future might look like. Some of the themes that I thought were particularly relevant for that will help determine the evolution of future cities were ideas around master planning, transportation and infrastructure, green architecture and urban farming, and then the digital revolution as it will play out in the sphere of smart cities. And then the final section of the book is called New Habitats, that looks at really more speculative, probably quite unlikely proposals, but again, things where architects have the opportunity to just explore in a bit of a freer way what the future city might look like.
Now, one of the things you look at is the role of megacities, which are clearly with us now, but how they can be shaped in the future to do good things for us as well. Because, again, one of the trends that you're looking at in this book is how we build cities that are more sustainable. Where do the projects in your book that look at the megacity, how do they envision that unfolding?
Megacities being cities with a population of more than 10 million inhabitants, the number of those is set to increase, is set to rise from around 33 in 2018 to around 43 in 2030. So to me, they encapsulate the idea that cities need planning. Even on a small scale, we've all been to great cities where everything works and everybody seems happy, but many of us have also spent time in cities where things are a bit more disorganized. There are a lot of problems, and that tends to happen when cities evolve too quickly. And that is certainly what's going on with a lot of megacities at the moment. The megacities that are projected to come into being in the next decade or so are all going to be in developing parts of the world, predominantly Africa and parts of Asia. So what I wanted to look at in that section of the book was how master planning can and should be implemented and encouraged to help ensure that when those cities evolve, they do so in a positive way, a way that avoids just development for development's sake or the increase of slums and poor quality housing without the amenities that people need. So the projects in the master planning and megacities section focused on ideas around how to make sure when you're planning new urban districts that you do so in a way that's providing the right sorts of amenities and just highlights the importance of design and architects' roles in that process.
One of the other trends you look at is the urban farming movement, which is envisaging now whole cities being able to sustain themselves by growing food on their rooftops, in their streets, on vertical walls. How far progressed are these ideas? And are there any particular examples that you thought were interesting?
In terms of urban farming, it just makes sense at the moment. The current food supply system is so inefficient and extremely bad for the environment. We all know that. There are a lot of social trends towards localism in general at the moment, particularly shopping local, cooking with local ingredients. So it makes sense to farm locally if possible. And yeah, at the moment, there's no reason not to grow food in cities. Space is the obvious issue, but vertical farming solutions provide an option for that. I think, as with many shifting trends in urban design, the success of it will be driven by technology. So if aquaponics and aeroponics are proven to be efficient ways of growing food in cities, then they can be used in that way. It's possible we could all have our own growing modules for growing food individually, as shown in some of the projects by people like Precht. Also, Glassier's FramLab proposal, which has modules for growing things on the street, which could be shared with the community. And in a more speculative vision, drones could be used to harvest plants or crops from these pods and sort of move them around to wherever they're needed. Stuff like that, maybe for the future, but I'm sure you've already discussed there are people growing crops on a reasonably large scale within cities, and projects in the book like Sasaki's proposal for an urban farm that just provide a demonstration of what these could look like if we were to implement them maybe on a larger scale.
And just if you go back 50 years to see what people's predictions were about the future of cities, especially around transportation, you would laugh when you looked back now. One of the projects, for example, that I know that you've looked at is the Sky Tower from Uber, which has the idea that we'll be all jumping in flying taxis and zooming around. And actually, I'm not sure what readers will think when they see the image that's suggestive of what this tower could look like. It's pretty hellish. It's brutal and huge and dominating. Not many cities would want it, certainly in their downtowns. When you looked at some of these projects, was it with an eye of thinking, look, I know it's a bit mad and crazy, but let's just get this out there? Were you trying to think, actually, there's something good here as well? Is it looking perhaps like a refashioned 1960s kind of brutalist tower?
Yeah, you're right. Some of the projects, the visual aesthetic of how they're presented, I think it's often intentionally quite provocative or, you know, a bit outlandish. I tried not to judge many of the projects too much on that. I was interested more in the ideas and presenting them as they are, as the architects intended to present them, so that the reader can then make up their own mind. But yeah, I think you're right. A lot of people see some of these visions as maybe a bit dystopian rather than utopian, but for sure the ideas are interesting. Yeah, in the past, of course, things like flying cars or traveling around on hoverboards, Back to the Future style, it seems silly, but in a lot of ways we're not too far away from that reality now. There's certainly a possibility of unmanned or driverless vehicles or drones being used in the future for deliveries, possibly for transportation. I also talk about Hyperloop in the book, which, you know, nobody knows how successful that's going to be. But if that or other forms of rapid transit take off, they really have the potential to disrupt how we view urban life, you know, potentially making it easier and faster for people and goods to move around in different ways, making proximity to urban centres less of an issue. You know, you could live 50 miles away from a city if you've got a drone or urban air mobility that's able to transport you direct to the city centre. I think the key thing with transportation is to consider what is actually important about it. Is it all about speed and convenience, or should the focus be on cleaner, greener, smarter solutions that free up space and optimize resources? So, yeah, there's some slightly outlandish, wacky things in the book, but it's the direction that we're likely to be heading in, and it's all about, is that the direction we want to go in or not?
That was Alan Griffiths, author of The Future City, Visionary Architecture and Design, which is available now from Lanu Publishers. And that's all for this edition of The Urbanist. Be sure to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts for your weekly dose of urbanism every Thursday, as well as our weekly sister show, Tall Stories, premiering every Monday. Today's episode was produced by Carlotta Ribello and David Stevens. And David also edited the show. And to play you out this week, here's 07 and Jose Gonzalez with Futures. Thank you for listening, City Lovers. Made a note of it. Did you write?